You are listening to audio from Riverside Church. If you would like to check out more resources, please visit riverside.church.
Well, it's good to be together again. If you weren't able to be with us last week, I probably don't look that familiar. My name's Adam. We've been talking about the way that Advent helps us sort of hold the pain of our world very honestly and to point our longings for a world made right in the right direction. And I was thinking might be helpful just to kind of know that, at least in my brain, I don't know if this will be the way it works or not, but in my brain, I'm thinking that the way we're talking about Advent gets increasingly more personal, individual over time. So we sort of talk about the pain of the world. And by the time we get to Advent, it'll be the stories of our own lives a little more intentionally. Not across the board, but that's kind of where we're headed. So I was been thinking about this gathering I went to about a month ago, and several people here in the church were part of it. It was a gathering put on by this organization, Faith in St. Joe County. And Jeff, you were there. I know that. There were others I know that were there. But it was, how many people were at that public action? Several hundred. 500 people in a church over here on the west side. All people of faith coming together. Because of the issue of violence, gun violence in particular, in our community. And we heard testimony, there was singing, there was demand for action to counteract the violence that we see in our neighborhoods. And I was sort of amazed by how many people from how many different faith traditions would gather together to say that. And I was thinking about it again this week, and was remembering how last week we talked about Romans chapter 8. And in Romans chapter 8, Paul says that all of creation is groaning because it's in bondage to decay, longing to be set free. And that even people of faith have the first fruits of the Spirit in them, that we also long for a world to be made right at the same time. And I thought, sometimes, even though God's people are always groaning inwardly, sometimes it spills out into meetings where 500 people gather together and say, God, make it right. This is not the way our community should be. We shouldn't have to long for liberation from violence, God. We want something different from our world. And just the number of people from every corner of South Bend, it made me think that we are a community that, in a firsthand sort of way, understands that we live in a very violent world. Yeah? Last night at 10 o'clock, and in the middle of the night at 3:30, we had a reminder of that at our house, because you can hear gunshots. I was thinking about it this morning as I drove here and see the makeshift memorials that dot our roadsides all over town. These little markers of violence, these things that are easy to overlook, too easy to drive by, this evidence that there is a family who has lost someone and due to very violent ways. And it strikes me that violence cuts in two directions, that it certainly has direct damage, that violence inflicts direct wounds on people. But violence also has collateral damage, doesn't it? That there are indirect wounds that violence perpetuates in our world. I think about those roadside markers, that those are put there by people who are collateral damage of violence because they experience loss because of violence and therefore are left to carry the wounds of pain that creates, and they now carry that with them. Violence also creates the collateral damage of fear. That we know that violence exists, that we know that violence can be random, And so that there is a constant fear that I will, or someone close to me will, experience violence. And so I walk around with a sense of worry for myself and for others. And it doesn't just have to be gun violence. Violence is all kinds of forms. I still remember the very first night I took the car out when I was 16. And being a good son that I always was, never doing anything wrong, I came home 15 minutes before my curfew. The first time I had the car, I came home 15 minutes before my curfew, and I still got in trouble. And I've often teased my mom about that after I got over it, bringing it up like 25 years later, so I'm not sure how over it I am. But I tease her, but it is an evidence that she's so worried that I would be dead, that worry would create a situation where, even in a perfectly fine situation, it spills out. It creates pain and fear and worry. And one of the things that I've noticed is that violence that creates pain and fear and worry, it solidifies division between people and people groups. It creates a barrier that's very hard to overcome. Division is what hatred eats for breakfast, because hatred feeds on it and it grows on it. And then we live in this world that gives rise to violence that's rooted in the division that's codified by violence. So how do we deal with that? How do we deal with division and hatred and the violence that it produces? I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan. And in particular, in the middle of the Two Towers is the great battle for the Kingdom of Rohan. And if you've read the books or seen the films, you know that Rohan is sort of backed into its own corner, and the forces of evil are all around, pressing in, and it's very clear that there is no hope, that they're just going to annihilate everyone. And the king of Rohan is a guy named Theoden. And at one point, he looks at Aragorn. That's like super weird names. I mean, come on, Tolkien. Theoden looks at Aragorn and he says, "What can men do against such reckless hate? What can men do against such reckless hate?" Does anybody ever feel that when you see the violence of our world? What can we do against such reckless hate? And Aragorn's answer is right out into it. "We will take the fight back to him. We will go and we will conquer violence with redemptive violence." I also think that's what the world is. We live in a violent world, but we also live in a world that believes that the only way to defeat violence is with more violence. And Dr. King in 1967 challenges that idea in a speech that was called "Where Do We Go From Here?" He said, "The ultimate weakness of violence is that it's a descending spiral, giving birth to the very thing it seeks to destroy. Instead of diminishing evil, it multiplies it. Through violence, you may murder the liar, but you can't murder the lie, nor establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder the hater, but you don't murder hate. In fact, violence merely increases hate. So it goes. Returning violence for violence multiplies violence, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Because darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies violence. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction." We live in a world, on the one hand, where violence gives birth to violence. Yes? That's why we need Advent. Because Advent, we are reminded and in a world that gives birth to violence, God gives birth to peace. We are reminded in Advent that there is a Messiah, a Prince of Peace, that is transforming and will transform a violent world. This is a very famous Advent passage, but it takes new life when we situate it in the world that we live in. In Isaiah chapter 9, Isaiah calls the people to not only remember God's faithfulness on the one hand, but to reach out and hold on to the hope of the coming Messiah in the other. When Isaiah says that the people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation. You have increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest. And I want you to catch the image that he now employs. They rejoice as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. Because just as the day that Midian was defeated, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them. Shattered the bar across the shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. And every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. Because unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. The what? Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. Did you hear it? There's a few thoughts as I reflect on this passage that we read every year at this time of year. And that is that Isaiah is saying what God wants us to see, and that is that liberation from our bondage to sin and brokenness that Paul is talking about, that freedom from oppression, it does not come by returning violence for violence. That's the great myth of our world. Dr. King had to have had an imagination soaked in Isaiah, because otherwise what he said doesn't make any sense. He knew that no light could pierce the darkness if we believed that that light was coming through violence. That true liberation, true freedom comes from the peace that God is giving birth to in the world through this coming king. This child, this son, will be called the Wonderful Counselor and the Mighty God, an Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. That king will shatter the yoke of the oppressor. It will free people from the burden of their enslavement. That is not just flowery language. When Isaiah says that every warrior's boot and every garment that's soaked in blood will be destroyed, what Isaiah is doing is picturing the day when all of the violence that racks our world is transformed into a new kind of kingdom because there is a new king seated on the throne. And that kind of kingdom, Isaiah says, is not going to be extended through violence or the threat of violence or the oppression of the vulnerable, even though that's how nearly every empire in the history of the world has extended and maintained its control. There's, Rome is one of the sort of go-to examples when you talk about an empire in the world, primarily because the Roman Empire was the empire when most of the scriptures were written. And Rome had this phrase that was on its coins and on the entryways to its cities, and you've probably heard this before. Somebody referred to it in social studies when you were in eighth grade, and that is the Pax Romana. Has anybody ever heard that phrase before? The Pax Romana. Translated means the peace of Rome. The peace of Rome. It was on all the coins that had the Caesar's faces on it. Meaning Caesar extends the peace of Rome Wherever you spend this dollar, the peace of Rome is extended. Now, the great irony, of course, to say that the peace of Rome extends to the ends of the earth is that Rome created that through military might. Rome maintained law and order across the kingdom through the use of force and through the use of deadly violence. In the days of Jesus and just after, Nero would light his city with the bodies of his enemies. Has anybody ever watched the Nativity Story film? You should watch that. That is the peace of Rome being extended in the way they would do it. And Isaiah says that there is a new kingdom. A new kingdom that will extend and be enlarged and be increased. The same way that you see all these warriors rejoice when they win a battle and divide their plunder, in this kingdom, all of that will be done away with, but the same kind of joy will come because the government will extend actual shalom. The king who sits on that throne will reign forever, not establishing it through violence and oppression, but with justice and righteousness. And I love the way that Isaiah says this at the end. He says, the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. You know, zeal is not a word we use today. The word we use today is passion. So we can translate that. It says, the passion of God will establish. Have you ever thought about God being passionate about something? I don't know about you, but I want to be passionate about the things that God is passionate about. And what Isaiah says is that God is passionate about peace. In a world racked with violence, God is passionate about peace. There's another passage that I want to read to you and tease out. That was Isaiah chapter 9, and I want us to look at Micah chapter 4. I'll read it to you, but if you want to read it later, you can check it out. This is Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 5. I hope that through this series, we're demonstrating that God is always saying, remember, Israel, that I'm faithful. But all throughout, the prophets are saying, and one day, just hold on to the fact that one day it will be right. It's everywhere. It's not just the one or two passages we read at Christmas. Micah chapter 4, we'll start with verses 1 and 2. In the last days, meaning that day, when this happens, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of mountains. It'll be exalted above the hills, and people will stream to it. Many nations will say, come, let's go up to the mountain of the Lord. Let's go to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we can walk in his paths. And the law will go out from Zion. The word of the Lord will come from Jerusalem. This is a kingdom vision. This is Micah talking about the kingdom that Isaiah was describing. Did you notice last week at the two passages we looked at, Jeremiah and Zechariah, both of those prophets were picturing a day where there was this kind of like gravitational pull to the kingdom of God. People like couldn't resist being drawn to the king. Well, that's what Micah's doing here. It says people from all over will say, let's go there. And the reason they're drawn to the king is because the king is turning the wrong and the bad in the world upside down. And that's what's going to happen here in Micah. They want to go see this king on this holy mountain because, as we read in verse 3, this king will judge between the peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. And they, meaning the nations, they will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. There is a lot in one verse right there. Here you have this king who is settling disputes between nations. What is the cause of most wars? Disputes between nations. Now you have a picture of a king who settles the disputes for them. So much so that they can like look at their armories and say, we don't really need these swords anymore. What can we do with them? Well, let's turn them into garden tools. They're going to take swords and they're going to then use them to plow their fields. They're going to take spears and they're going to be the things that they use to trim their vines. I want you to see what's really the image here is that the things that used to take life become tools used to cultivate new life. Instead of death, there is life. Nations will not go to war anymore. And I love that last little bit. It almost feels like a throwaway line. Nations won't go to war anymore and they won't even train for it. Why? Because war is not even in the imaginative possibility of the world. So you don't have to train for it. You don't have to practice killing. It's not peace through the threat of violence. It's not a peace through mutually assured destruction. We don't have to train for it because war is not the means to the end. Verse 3 is this big global vision. Now I want you to listen to verse 4. And everyone will sit under their own vine and their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid. For the Lord Almighty has spoken. I want you to think about that. I think that's really saying something. If we lived in a world where there wasn't violence, kids weren't being shot in the street, if the best option for some kids was not to graduate from high school and go learn to kill others, what would change about our world? Well, you could sit under your own vine and your own fig tree, and you wouldn't be afraid anymore. Or to put it on the west side, we could sit on the front stoop and not worry who was going to shoot us as they drove by. Everyone will sit and will not be afraid. You know that collateral damage of violence, of fear and worry and pain and loss is gone. That's the nice thing about peace is that it's not possible for there to be collateral damage. You don't have to make those kind of calculations. It's a global vision for peace. To be sure, a cosmic peace, but one that has cardiological effects. My heart rate won't beat too fast anymore in that world. In verse 5, Micah says, all the nations may walk in the name of their gods, but we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. He says, all the nations can walk in the name of their gods. That's kind of like Micah saying, come what may. Everybody else can do what they want to do. Everybody else is going to do what they're going to do. But we won't do what they do. We won't fall in line. See, friends, this is the hope of Advent, summed up in a single verse. Everybody else can do what they're going to do. Everybody else can get lost in sentimentality, or it can be overwhelmed by their own bitterness or fear or pain. They can be overwhelmed by it or try to hide and put their head in the sand, but we will not do that. Come what may, we will hold on to the Prince of Peace. When Israel was looking forward to that Messiah who would come, we will hold on to the fact that Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And if we're reaching back for that, we ought to expect that there's some evidence that we also can reach forward to remember that one day, that's the world we will live in too. Well, God gave us that. In Revelation 7, you have John saying, I looked around and there was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation and tribe and people and language. And they were all standing before the throne and before the Lamb. Sounds like what Micah was looking forward to happens. In Revelation, they were all wearing white robes and holding palm branches in their hands, palm branches being a sign both of kingship and peace. And they cried out in a loud voice, salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. you remember the other time palm branches were referred to in the New Testament? The triumphal entry of Jesus as he rides into Jerusalem to ultimately bring peace to the world. Everyone sort of almost ironically seeing that this is the King, the Prince of Peace, coming. You won't have to say like Micah said in verse 5, all the other nations can do what they want to do. John didn't have to say that because all the nations have seen it for what it is and come to the King saying salvation belongs to our God. There are no other gods to chase after. Everyone has seen what is good and right and true. The defining characteristic of that crowd, John says, that this is a crowd made up of every nation and tribe and people and language. Those are like the first four things we use to codify division and hatred in the world. And yet they become the defining characteristics of this kingdom of peace gathered around the throne of Jesus. Truly worth celebrating. Because Jesus is bringing about a world, and one day will fully bring a world to bear where peace has taken root and has choked out the very violence that threatens to suffocate us every day. So, I want to circle back to Theoden's question. What can we do against such reckless hate? What can we do? Well, I agree with the first part of what Aragorn said. We do ride out against it. But not by returning violence for violence or championing some kind of vengeance or revenge or retaliation that's so prevalent in our world, but by carrying the banner of the Prince of Peace. In other words, if violence gives birth to violence, but God gives birth to peace, we ought to ask ourselves, what are we giving birth to in the world? What are we giving birth to in the world? Jesus, as he stood on the side of the mountain and preached his most famous sermon, said, "Blessed are those who return violence for violence," because that's the way the world works. No, he said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, because they will be called the children of God." We hold out the hope of Advent by seeking to extend the peace of Jesus into the world as a sign that we have been born again of God. We talked about it last week, how all of creation is in prison to its own falling apart. All of creation is longing for the children of God to show up. Well, the children of God, Jesus says, show up making peace in a violent world. Because violence, at a basic root, is the failure to recognize the begottenness of another person. Violence is the failure to see that that is a child of God. That those people are children of God. And so when we, as the people of God, when we celebrate violence, when we cheer it on, when we believe the myth of redemptive violence, it means that we've put our hope into something that amounts to the rejection of the hope of Advent. We've reached out and we've grabbed on to the wrong thing, and we've pointed our longings for a world made right in a direction that will always multiply the thing we long to be rid of. Away, ultimately, from the Prince of Peace. That's why Jesus says, "You should be peacemakers." And being a peacemaker begins with the ability to see the child of God in every person. Being a peacemaker means having the courage to honor the child of God in every person in a world that so casually inflicts violence and celebrates revenge and retribution. So very practically, I think that that's why prayer is radical. Prayer is radical because it is like exercise for our longings. We pray for a world to be set free from its bondage to decay by praying for peace in the midst of violence, and to do so as concretely as possible. I used to work with a pastor in Baltimore, and Baltimore also is a city that has a bit of a reputation for violence. And he and his church, any night that there was a murder or a shooting in the city, he and his church knew that at some time the next morning they were going to show up at that spot as the church and pray that God would make the world right and trust that the Spirit of God actually is in their midst and to declare this space for the King of Peace. They said, this is Jesus' corner now. I think that's one way we live it out, is to learn how to train our own hopes in that direction. But I also think that's why forgiveness is an essential Christian practice. I think one of the ways that we pull the rug out from violence and revenge is by being a people who don't savor comeuppance, recognizing that that doesn't taste quite as good as mercy. It's pretty radical to try and be a people of forgiveness in a world that's hell-bent on retribution. Reconciliation is the work of bringing peace into the violent breakdowns in our world. And I mean that interpersonally. I mean that between people groups. That's one of the reasons I think Paul says that the church is an ambassador of reconciliation. That's a political term, and for good reason, because we are citizens of a kingdom of peace, so we are ambassadors of peace, of bringing people together across these kinds of lines. So remember last week, the little kitchen dance? I won't take time to read it, but in Ephesians chapter 2, Paul tells us that the church is like the first taste of a community where peace is being brought in a midst of division. He says that that Jesus is making a single humanity out of all the division of the world. That Jesus made peace between people because he shed his blood. And in doing that, he has destroyed the dividing wall of hostility. That means that the church is the first taste the world gets of that Revelation 7 picture, where people from all over are brought together in a single community. Jesus is bringing together a people that get to taste it ourselves. Oh, this is what it will be like one day. But also we are the people that get to like put that on display for the world. Because here's the thing, the world thinks that returning violence for violence is all there is. That's our only option. What other choice is there? The only other story, the only story capable of like ending that is the story that we gather around this table week in and week out to reenact together. So who's going to tell the world that story if not us? Jesus is putting us back together in a community where we might be called the children of God, citizens of a kingdom of peace, ruled by the Prince of Peace, full of citizens who celebrate peace and shalom and mourn violence. So everybody else can do what they want. They can return violence for violence. They can cheer and champion the destruction of violence in the world. They can believe in the myth of redemptive violence. But we will walk in the name of the Lord forever. We will do that because we bear the name of the one who didn't extend violence, but came into our world to bear up the violence of the world in his own body in order to redeem us and set us free from our addiction to death. This, friends, is how we pull our hands together in the everyday now. It's how we direct our longings now. I don't think any of us want violence. But what do we do with our longing for a world made right? More particularly, in whom do we put our trust for peace? The invitation of Advent is to wait on purpose for the Prince of Peace. That is not easy, and it does require courage. My favorite Christmas hymn, I think it's a hymn, is I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day. I'll call it a carol. It's probably not a hymn. It's actually a poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, and the first couple of verses are kind of like traditionally Christmas schmaltz. He's like walking around. So picture this person like walking around hearing all the church bells ring out on Christmas Day and all the feelings that you would have potentially if you listen to that. Okay, so that's kind of like where it goes. But then the third verse, the whole poem sort of takes this turn. And he says, he's walking around listening to all these bells ring, and he says, "And in despair, I bow my head. There is no peace on earth," I said, "because hate is strong, and it mocks the song of peace on earth and goodwill to men." That's the world we live in, yeah? The fourth verse. "Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor does he sleep. The wrong shall fail, and right will prevail. With peace on earth, goodwill to men." Just want to give us a reflection question here to sit with for a few moments before Kelsey comes to lead us to the table. And it's the question I've already asked. We live in a world that gives birth to violence. We follow a God who gives birth to peace. So what am I giving birth to in the world? Let's take just a few moments to reflect on that question before we come to the table.
On the night that Jesus was betrayed, the night that he invited his friends and his betrayer to the table to eat the bread of his body broken and drink the wine of his blood poured out, he also said this: "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your hearts be troubled, and do not be afraid." Jesus is again reminding them that his ways are totally different than the ways of the world. I'm not a scholar or a theologian, but I think that Jesus wasn't saying, "Don't ever feel fear." I think he was saying, "Don't make your home in, like, fear city. Don't lay down at night. Don't put up your tents in campground fear." He's reminding his disciples that there's a different way, and that the reason they can refuse to live in fear is because they won't be alone. Even when Jesus is no longer present with them in person, a reality that we all live with every day, they can still be at rest, because the Prince of Peace sends his Holy Spirit to be with us. And if you know Jesus, you have the power to resist fear and to embrace peace. Because peace is not a feeling. It's the very presence of Christ himself. So during Advent, we're going to ask those of you in the most close rows right here to go ahead and come on up. And then once the person in front of you has gone, please just come on up. You can take the elements here at the table, or you can take them back to your seats. And as you come, remember that the world says that peace is only possible if your circumstances are what you want them to be. But the peace Christ offers is not a change in your circumstances, but the gift of his presence. Emmanuel, God with us. The power in this is that if Christ, the Prince of Peace, lives in you, then you take peace wherever you go to. Receive peace, friends, and be quick to birth it into the world.
Thank you for listening to Riverside Church. For more resources, visit riverside.church.